Born in 1921 as the fourth of seven children, his parents were admirers of Marcus Garvey. His father was an outspoken Baptist lay minister, and both of his parents were leaders in the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Four of his uncles were killed by white violence. His parents moved several times because of KKK threats against their family. They were harassed by a white racist group called the Black Legion because of his parents' political activities. His father was rumored to have been killed by that group. His mother was then committed to a mental hospital, and he and his siblings were separated and placed into foster homes. He left high school in 1941 before graduating, after a white teacher told him that practicing law was no realistic goal for a nigger. In 1943, he moved to Harlem and engaged in petty crime. While there, he befriended a man who would later be known as the famous comedian we now call Red Fox. He was declared mentally unstable for military service because he told the draft board during early World War II, "I want to be sent down south. Organize them nigger troops, steal me some guns, and kill some crackers." He began serving an 8 to 10 year sentence for larceny and breaking and entering in 1946. While in prison, he embarked on a program to educate himself and developed an appetite for reading everything he could put his hands on. His name was Malcolm Little. In 1950, he began signing his name as Malcolm X after becoming a member of the Nation of Islam while in prison. In 1957, the American public first became aware of Malcolm X as the spokesman for the Nation of Islam after Hinton Johnson, a Nation of Islam member, was beaten by two New York police officers. You most certainly already know the fabled story of Martin Luther King Jr., who was 7 years younger than Malcolm X and was born into a family of Black ministers. But what is not commonly known is how bitter he was against white people because of the daily humiliation Black people endured in the segregated South. During his adolescence, King became skeptical of the most fundamental claims of Christianity, such as the bodily resurrection of Jesus and the literalist Bible teachings. In his junior year of high school, in 1941, he won an oratorical contest sponsored by the Elks Club in Dublin, Georgia. In the speech, King stated, "Black America still wears chains. The finest Negro is at the mercy of the meanest white man. Even winners of our highest honors face the class color bar." King's feud with Christianity subsided after his junior year at Morehouse College. It was then that he concluded the church offered an answer to his inner urge to serve humanity. His ambition was to be a rational minister with sermons that would be respectful force of ideas, even social protest. He received his PhD in systematic theology on June 5th, 1955. By 1957, King had joined with other civil rights activists to form the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and became immersed in the attempt to force civil rights reform by using the moral authority and power of Black churches with nonviolent protest. I was born in 1956, right about the time that both King and X were becoming well known for their civil rights activities. When X was assassinated, I was 9 years old, and I was nearly 12 when King was assassinated. I was a news hound from the earliest time that I can remember. And even at a very young age, I knew that I could not accept the kind of degradation and humiliation my parents had to endure as African Americans in this nation. That was going to stop with me, one way or another. As I grew older, I became aware that I was part of a generation that carried the messages of both men simultaneously. King saying, turn the other cheek when struck, and X saying, anytime you tell a man to turn the other cheek or to be nonviolent in the face of a violent enemy, you're making that man defenseless. You're robbing him of his God-given right to defend himself. But that was the psychic tension that has existed within me my entire life. It was also the tension that the United States lived in during the tumultuous years of the Civil Rights era. Now, people often tend to compare Martin Luther King Jr.'s approach towards the civil rights movement in the United States with Malcolm X's approach. Some feel our country dodged a bullet by taking King's nonviolent path. They erroneously believe that we reached some measure of social balance and were somehow saved from the Malcolm X's scarier path. We did not achieve any balance. What we achieved was hysteresis, which is a term I borrow from science to describe any system whose response depends not only on its current sense, but also on its past history. And it means that when you push on something, it will yield. But when you release the force applied, it does not spring back completely. I speak, of course, of the history that produced both remarkable men. I could include other great civil rights luminaries, such as James Baldwin, Eldridge Cleaver, Maya Angelou, Rosa Parks, Barbara Jordan, Medgar Evers, Paul Robeson, John Lewis, Stokely Carmichael, Jesse Jackson, James Meredith, and Thurgood Marshall. And the list goes on. But on a day like today, when we honor the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., I feel it is important to also acknowledge his most powerful alter ego. And it's fitting that the term alter ego can mean both a person's secondary or alternate personality and an intimate and trusted friend. The historical relationship between the two men thus belies the philosophical, moral, and spiritual dimensions of their impact on my generation. The psychic balance I speak of between the two, in my own mind, amplifies the terrible symmetry of oppression. That symmetry is written in the language of historical failure and missed opportunities. You see, the problem is we talk about the eras of Reconstruction and the era of civil rights, as if they are past remnants of a challenging but resolved time. So what era are we in now? The three strikes and you're out era? So eloquently put by Dr. Eddie Gloud Jr. I'll talk about him a little bit later. But obviously, what I call the hysteresis in race relations in this country occurs because we never got it right. The moral imperative to correct slavery that resulted in the Reconstruction era, and then the moral imperative to correct the racist reaction to Reconstruction, embodied by the quote, civil rights era, both lasted for a very short time. America passed amendments to the Constitution. It promised land and mules. It changed some laws about voting rights and discrimination, but not hearts and minds. And then it said, we're done. And that's why in this era of third strike and you're out, I recently heard someone from a political cult say, there's no such thing as racism. If an African American hasn't been able to succeed in this nation for the past 50 years, it's their own fault. And that is why we are here, afraid this very day, that angry people having a temper tantrum might violate the sanctuaries of liberal churches who support the concept that no one race is superior to another. The response to the ever-present racism in our country clearly demonstrates that what King fought so hard to eradicate is still alive and well. That road of nonviolence and moral indignation he wanted us to take has led us to about the same place where we started 50 years later. And it's a bitter irony that Black people are now told that we are not protesting the murder of other Black people in the streets in our nation correctly. The disapproval that Martin Luther King Jr. would have against violence is now invoked as the standard for good and appropriate behavior. So now let's take a look at King's counterbalance, the strikingly handsome but terrible Dark Knight, iconically photographed by Don Hogan Charles for Ebony magazine, peeking through his windows, his curtains with a M1 carbine in his hand. Here's a quick little bit of historical trivia. Did you know that King and X only met each other one time on March 26, 1964, less than a year before X's death? Did you also know that in early 1965, while King was jailed in Selma, Alabama, X traveled to Selma, where he had a private meeting with Coretta Scott King, and he told her, "I didn't come to Selma to make his job more difficult. I really did come thinking that I could make it easier. If the white people realize what the alternative is, perhaps they'd be more willing to hear Dr. King." Isn't that fascinating? Malcolm was keenly aware of his role as King's alter ego in the mind of a frightened American public over 50 years ago. After all, what is more terrifying than an armed, self-assured Black nationalist who insists on holding government, religion, and corporations accountable for their treatment of African Americans? But hold on here. Let's flash forward 50 years. What's more terrifying than an armed, self-assured Black nationalist who insists on holding government, religion, and corporations accountable for their treatment of African Americans? If you, in all honesty, think the answer is nothing, then one, you are absolutely correct. Two, you're part of the problem. And three, you've just acknowledged that nothing has significantly changed. In his brilliant 2020 book entitled Begin Again, author Eddie S. Gloud Jr. chronicled how James Baldwin, who knew both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, was disillusioned by the fact that the civil rights movement failed to force America to confront its pernicious lies about race. In Begin Again, Gloud emerges as a powerful witness to Baldwin's searing commentary about the civil rights era through his own analysis of our uncomfortably parallel time. Gloud also provides a fascinating interpretation of how the Reconstruction, civil rights, and present eras are all uncomfortably related. James Baldwin insisted that he had not been part of a civil rights movement. He agreed with Malcolm X that if a person is a citizen, then they shouldn't have to fight for their civil rights. In an interview in 1964 for his book, Who Speaks for the Negro, Baldwin said the civil rights movement was definitely not a revolution, saying, "It is a very peculiar revolution because it has to have at its ends the establishment of a union and a radical shift in the American mores, the American way of life, not only as it applies to the Negro, obviously, but as it applies to every citizen of the country." then, as late as 1979, he hammered the final nail in the coffin of the civil rights movement by calling it the latest slave rebellion. Typically, Baldwin was brutally right on. Now, I will shamelessly use Baldwin as a fulcrum point with which to find a balance between King and X. The scary firebrand that most associate with the image of Malcolm X actually changed many of his positions towards the end of his life. After his break from the Nation of Islam and his pilgrimage to Mecca in 1964, he said that seeing Muslims of all colors, from blue-eyed blondes to black-skinned Africans, interacting as equals, led him to see Islam as a means by which racial problems could be overcome. He repudiated his stance on the separation of black people from white people, although he continued to advocate for self-determination for African-American communities. He also stressed a more global perspective in the struggle for equal rights. For his part, by 1965, King had broadened his political and social landscape. His influence as a civil rights leader actually was waning as he revealed a wider range of other issues such as open housing, opposition to the Vietnam War, and economic justice. His vision was increasingly more for revolution than for simple reform. He began to criticize systematic flaws of racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. And he asserted that reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced. Both men changed and broadened their views over time. To most people in the United States, King was a godly and safe person, while Malcolm X was threatening and violent. King had a dream and he was killed for it. X had an awakening and he was killed for that. Towards the end of his life, Martin Luther King said that white supremacy is the great barrier to democracy. On January 6th, 2021, we witnessed a mob of people incited to violence by our president to attack the very heart of our democracy. What motivated them to do this? Certainly, the president and his fellow power-craven partners were instigators, but let's be frank. The fundamental causes of the attack are the fear that that the privilege white Americans have enjoyed for so long is coming to an end. The government that betrayed that privilege is now the target of their fury. We live in two countries, two realities. On one hand, we must uphold the rights of all citizens to express their opinions, fear, anger, frustration, pain, prejudices, and yes, ignorance. On the other hand, we must guard against harm to others because of those expressions. We must choose whether to live in a democracy with an egalitarian, racially diverse, creative marketplace of competing ideas, or live in an authoritarian regime which stifles creativity and comforts conformity. Change indeed happens slowly, but it must be balanced against the expediences of the moment. The balance of forces is what Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. understood. Both men were correct in their assessment of the culture in which we live. And you notice, I said that consciously, because the culture they lived in is essentially the same one we live in today. It is a culture rotted from and hollowed out by racism that has yet to be fundamentally addressed. Malcolm and Martin offer a holistically balanced approach towards our present crisis. They admonish us to view our situation like the mythical Janus that looks both forward and backwards. Deliberate decisive, and now courageous action must arise from both an acknowledgement of our racist past and a vision of a racist-free future. And now, it's very clear, every day we delay puts us in deeper peril. What can you do? Challenge your friends and family to move beyond deer-eyed apathy to clear-eyed action. All of us, of all ethnicities and races, should read about the lives and work of great civil rights leaders for guidance in navigating these even more dangerous waters. We saw, after the storming of our nation's capital, that there are great forces of violent hatred arrayed against the notion of liberal democracy. So, organize, commit, confront, reaffirm. Act with both king-like kindness and ex-like purpose. We will see a better and more just world. We just can't pray about it anymore. Namaste.